Good afternoon, Your Honors. My name is Audrey Weiss. My registration number is 16166. I'm a deputy district attorney in Jefferson County, and I represent the people who are the appellant in this matter. What we are asking the court to do is to vacate the trial court's order of July 23rd, 2010, remand to the trial court to reinstate the trial court's order of July 10th, 2006. The people's position in this case, Your Honors, is that when the trial court made the determination in 2010 to hear this case under a Rule 59 motion and pursuant to 16-13-307, that the court did not have jurisdiction or authority to do so. 3.5 years prior to that, the trial court had entered an order of forfeiture after a full hearing and making written findings, had ordered the property to be forfeited, found that under the public nuisance statutes, the money was in fact a public nuisance, and ordered the money to be distributed pursuant to statute. It was then done so. It is the people's position that in 2010, when the motion was filed by the defendant in this particular case to asking the court to vacate the prior order and return the money, the court had no jurisdiction at that time. The race, the property, was gone. It was gone. It had been distributed pursuant to court order, and the trial court had no jurisdiction or authority to even hear the case. It's our position that at that time the court should have summarily denied the motion, indicating it had lost jurisdiction over the matter. The appellee in this case had also filed the motion pursuant to 16-13-307. That statute is not applicable as well, as that statute 1.6 relates to seized property. In 2010, the property was no longer seized property. 3.5 years earlier, it had been declared forfeited and distributed. So that statutory provision does not apply either. So that is our position, that the court erred in hearing the case, the court erred in vacating its prior order and ordering that the money be returned.
Ms. Weiss, you said at the beginning of your statement that that there is a Rule 59 motion. Did you mean a Rule 60 motion?
I apologize. Yes, a Rule 60 motion. It was filed pursuant to Rule 60 and 16-13-307.
I'd just like to follow up in regard to that. Because one of your arguments is that the trial court didn't specify which subsection of Rule 60B it was relying on. Is that a fundamental error, or can we say, well, looking at Rule 60B, we think that such and such section applies?
I think the appellee in his response brief went through the different subsections and noted where he thought it was appropriate. The court may have made its ruling. It's our position that any of the subsections would not have applied, as the court was hearing a case basically for something that didn't exist. So I think my overall argument is it wouldn't have mattered which subsection. The subject matter was gone at that point. The court had no jurisdiction at all under Rule 60.
Well, if I can pierce through what you're saying, it sounds like you're at least not disagreeing with Mr. Walter's statement that the trial court, that we as an appellate court can say, well, we think that the trial court acted properly under one of the subsections of Rule 60B if we were to reach that conclusion. That, in other words, that the trial court's failure to mention a particular subsection was not fatal.
I think specifically the answer to your question is yes. Failure to not mention a subsection is not fatal.
Okay.
My position is more generalized.
Right. I understand. Thanks.
Thank you.
When were the funds dispersed?
The order for distribution was... there was a written order in July of 2006, and the money was, or there was a motion order for distribution filed shortly thereafter that, signed off by the court, and the money was distributed at the end of 2006.
So at that point, no matter how much money was involved, the defendant lost any ability to ever recover that money. Is that the position?
That's our position, because at the time that the court entered the ruling in this particular case on July 10th, 2006, it's our position that if the defendant wished to preserve any appellate rights, he could have filed several different options for stays. He could have filed a timely Rule 59 motion at that point. He could have filed an appeal and asked for a stay for an appeal. So once that time passed where he did not request a stay, file a Rule 59 motion and or an appeal, that was it. The money was then distributed. And again, as I stated, the property itself was just, it's gone. It's gone.
Would he have gotten a stay without posting a bond?
I don't know that answer under this particular case, Your Honor. I apologize.
Sorry.
I don't know that answer for this particular case.
That's
I apologize.
Fine.
But it was very clear that his criminal case was pending an appeal at that point. It's even mentioned in the record in the hearing on the merits. So if he wished to preserve this for appeal pending the ruling on the criminal case, he certainly could have done that, asked for a stay in this case till that case was determined.
What about the specific language of Section 1613.307.1.6, which seems to indicate that if a decision is reversed, that the property should be returned to its original owner?
Well, Your Honor, I would beg to differ with Your Honor that the language says if a decision is reversed. I think 1.6 relates to a situation prior to a full hearing on the merits in the forfeiture case. And 1.6, it's my position, our position does not apply because it relates to seized property, shall be dismissed and the seized property shall be returned. So in this particular case, the forfeiture case was stayed pending resolution of the criminal case. He was convicted in the criminal case. Then the forfeiture case went to a hearing on the merits. Once the hearing on the merits was resolved, the property was determined to be forfeited by the court and then distributed. So the nature of the property is no longer seized property. It is now categorized as forfeited and distributed property. So it's our position that 1.6 only relates to a circumstance prior to a hearing on the merits. And I know the appellee also talks, and we talk about Section 1.7C, where if a plaintiff proves by clear and convincing evidence, and then it relates what you would have to prove, a judgment of forfeiture may be entered without a criminal conviction of an owner. And that's 1613.307.1.7C. It's our position in this case that because the case went to a full hearing on the merits, based on the court's written ruling, indicated that the plaintiff has, quote, more than established by clear and convincing evidence that the property was traceable proceeds of the offense and that Mr. Strand was not an innocent owner. So pursuant to that subsection, a criminal conviction would not even need to be necessary for the money to be forfeited. But I think, Your Honor, going back to the original question, I think when the motion was filed in 2010, 1.6 did not apply because the property at that point was no longer seized property.
Why isn't money fungible? Couldn't just different funds be returned to Mr. Strand?
I apologize for interrupting. Money is the same as any other property in civil forfeiture proceedings. It is an item. That is actually what was taken from him. It would be no different than if it was a house or a car, which was subsequently destroyed or sold. It is then distributed. So part of the issue here too, Your Honor, is recognizing that it's money. Number one, it's our position it shouldn't be treated any differently than any other property. Number two, as with any other property, a house or a car, there needs to be some finality in this case. So if that is the property, it should be looked at as any other property.
Do you have any authority for the proposition that if money is treated the same as other types of property that are not fungible?
No, I don't, Your Honor. I do not. I think part of that too, Your Honor, in saying because it's money, years later we could overrule that, original ruling and order that the money be returned. I mean, it also begs the question of finality of a civil case. But as I indicated previously, there are certain steps that the defendant, the appellee, could have taken to preserve his right to this appeal, knowing that the criminal case, the parallel case, was being appealed. However, because he did not take those steps, and there was a subsequent ruling in a parallel case, it would take away the finality from that case years later. If you have been awarded something through a full finding, then again, you would have to go back years later and say to these agencies, because it's not the district attorney's office who has all the money or the police who have all the money, it was distributed to four different agencies. We gave you this years ago, you've spent it, it's gone, but somehow you have to come up with it again. Forfeiture money is supervised and spent through a specific statutorily created forfeiture board.
Counsel has made the suggestion that conceded that monies that were still with the district attorney or that had been dispersed to the district attorney, subject to getting over the hurdles you've previously described, could be returned. Is that correct?
In the written answer initially in this case, which was not filed by myself, was filed by a member of our office, I believe what he indicated was, but I'm being recorded, I shouldn't strike. I believe what he indicated was a certain percentage statutorily is given to the clerk's office of the district court clerk. So if the clerk's office still has some money, perhaps that money could be returned. I'm not sure I actually agree with that, but clearly that was put forward by a member of my office. I mean, my position overall is the money's gone, it's been distributed, and the defendant, the appellee, did not take the steps necessary to preserve this. You're welcome.
Ms. Weiss, it sounds like you're suggesting that, or maybe saying directly, that in any case involving forfeiture, that the person who was the original owner of the money must always take steps to make sure that nothing happens to the property, or that it in fact, to make sure that it cannot even be distributed until the related criminal case is finally determined. Is that your position?
Well, I think, Your Honor, a civil case is clearly different than a criminal case, because in a criminal case, prosecution is sort of given the idea of the job of doing justice and watching out somewhat for both sides. In a civil case, I think it's different. And I do think that when the people file the forfeiture case, follow the steps they need to follow, in this case, had a full hearing, presented more than sufficient evidence showing that the money was drug money, that it should be forfeited, he was the true owner, etc. Once the court issues that ruling, there are certain steps, as in any other civil case, where the burden then would shift to the appellee to take some steps to preserve an appellate right. Does that answer your question, Anna?
Well, I think it does in part, but I'm just wondering what your view is about the General Assembly's intent in enacting Section 307, subsection 1.6, which specifically talks about returning property after a criminal case has been decided so that it results in an acquittal or dismissal.
Sure. Okay. I think, again, these statutes, the forfeiture public nuisance statutes relate to property, how it's taken, that it's held, if a forfeiture hearing should be then held, and then if the defendant is acquitted or the case is dismissed in the criminal case at that stage of the proceedings, then the seized property would go back to the defendant. Now, I'm not sure that I would always agree with that either. There may be certain circumstances where several people are charged and you could still proceed with a forfeiture case even if the criminal case is dismissed, and there is authority on that.
Right, but what happens in a situation like the one here where the criminal conviction isn't reversed until an appeal? then that seems to present the problem that we have here.
Under the current statutory scheme, if the defendant appellee did not preserve their appellate rights as to the money, again, as in any other civil case, which he certainly could have done, he did file subsequent motion, Rule 59 motion, which was filed too late, and the court dismissed summarily. There was a Rule 60 motion filed, which the court denied on its merits. So even though this defendant was pro se at that time, he did file motions with the court. I think these statutes are pre-hearing, predetermination of changing the seized money to forfeited money to distributed money. And the statutes clearly state that if the no stay shall be issued pending an appeal if the court finds for the plaintiff. It's stated clearly in the statute. Therefore, because the rules of civil procedure apply, he would have to follow the rules of civil procedure for his appellate process.
Thank you. I see your time is up. Thank you, Ms. Weiss.
Thank you very much.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the court, Mark Walter, registration number 30990, appearing on behalf of Brad Strand, the appellee in this matter, who was previously adjudicated the true owner of the $11,200 of U.S. currency that is the subject of this forfeiture action. I have prepared remarks, but I think I'm just going to jump into the court's questions that were directed at Ms. Weiss. And what I'd like to do first is look specifically at the language of 1.7 and direct the court's attention to a couple of things that I think are relevant in terms of determining the intent of the legislature and whether or not this provision is applicable to a situation like this. And I find it significant that if you look at the sort of intervening clause, unless the forfeiture action was brought pursuant to one or more of the paragraphs of 1.7, the use of the past tense there, I think, is significant, particularly when coupled with the last clause of that sentence, if the case has been adjudicated as to all other claims, interests, and owners. That suggests to me that the legislature wasn't simply contemplating a situation in which there's been an acquittal or a dismissal in the criminal action prior to the hearing on the merits in the forfeiture action, that in fact you could have a situation where there's been an adjudication of rights and interests in the forfeiture action, and that it clearly encompasses the situation as Ms. Weiss suggests, where you do have an acquittal or dismissal prior to the hearing on the merits. But I think that the legislature also contemplates a situation like this one, where a criminal case goes up on appeal. There's been reversal or vacature in the appellate courts. And in the case of reversal, the case comes back down and is either dismissed or after a retrial, there's an acquittal. I don't see anything in there, the rest of the statutory scheme, to suggest that these individuals, particularly in a case such as this one, where the forfeiture order is inextricably linked to the criminal conviction, that they don't have a remedy. And, you know, frankly, as a general matter, I find the district attorney's position troubling. You know, the power of the government to proceed against property under civil forfeiture is well settled. We're not disputing that. It has a strong basis in history. But the notion that the government can take your property on the basis of a criminal conviction, and then when you're acquitted or the conviction is dismissed, they don't have to give it back, I think is troubling, simply on a common sense level.
Counsel, what about Ms. Weiss's argument that the defendant here, Mr. Strand, could have, not the defendant here, but Mr. Strand, I guess he is the defendant, could have either appealed the judgment of the court in the civil action or could have sought some kind of stay? Doesn't his failure to do so prevent him from now coming back, or does it prevent him from coming back?
Well, I know, but let's not lose sight of the fact that Mr. Strand was imprisoned and proceeding pro se during this case. I don't think that that's a fact that we should lose sight of. The fact of the matter is that the forfeiture statute itself specifically precludes a stay upon the appeal of the criminal conviction. I would note that Mr. Strand filed several motions after the order of forfeiture entered what I viewed as an attempt to stay the distribution of the funds or to at least to set aside the judgment. He filed an objection to a supplemental order in early August 2006, citing there the pending appeal in the criminal case, among other things. He again cited the appeal as grounds for setting aside the judgment, a Rule 59 motion filed in late August 2006. He again noted the pendency of an appeal in a criminal case in a pro se 60B2 motion filed in late November 2006, which is about the time that the funds were put on the court's registry and distributed. The point being that this pro se defendant, I think, did everything in his power in an effort to stop the speeding train in this case, and was unsuccessful in that. You know, the other reality is, and I note this in the brief, and I'll expand on it a little bit here, you know, the notion that he could have raised the constitutional Fourth Amendment issues in the civil forfeiture action, I think is exceedingly questionable. There had already been an evidentiary hearing in the criminal case and a ruling by the trial court. I've cited to one case, I think a Second Circuit case, that's illustrative of my review of the case law, which stands for the proposition that when you have a ruling, an adverse ruling on a suppression motion in a parallel criminal matter, you're stopped either collaterally or under a version of crossover estoppel from relitigating that in the context of the forfeiture action. So I don't know by what mechanism he would have asserted this defense and then sought an appeal on that basis. I think, you know, for the most part, his position in the forfeiture proceedings, and granted he took a number of different positions, but there was an allegation that this was the result of an illegal seizure. And a unanimous panel of this court agreed with him ultimately. You know, unfortunately, that was 4 years after the order of forfeiture entered, almost 4 years.
Mr. Walter, is there a different obligation that a defendant or a defense attorney would have if the object confiscated were not cash, which, as Judge Terry noted, is fungible?
I mean, it might be. If your desire is to, you know, get back your 1958 Chevy that's in mint condition, my suggestion to you would be that you take action to ensure that it's preserved. With cash being the fungible commodity that it is, I can tell you that it's not terribly important to Mr. Strand that he get back precisely the $11,200 that were seized from him.
But what then is your response to Ms. Weiss's point that the money here was distributed to four entities through specific funds and through some kind of board that is responsible for allocating this money?
Well, I mean, I suppose that my response is that sorry we've spent the money has never been a valid defense in Colorado courts. It was never their money to spend, in reality. The money was illegally seized. This court so determined. The underlying criminal conviction was ultimately dismissed as a result of that unlawful conduct. You know, my view is the same rule should apply to the government. When the government takes something that they're not entitled to take, they have an obligation to return it.
So in essence, it sounds like what you're saying is that any agency that receives money in a situation like this really is conditionally receiving it pending the outcome of appeals in a related criminal case.
To the extent that the prosecution elects to pursue a forfeiture action on the basis of a criminal conviction, as they did in this case, and they have options under 1.7. As Ms. Weiss pointed out, they don't necessarily have to proceed with a criminal conviction. But in this case, they elected to. And I think when the prosecution does that, there needs to be a recognition that, a criminal conviction is always subject to reversal, theoretically, at least. And, if you distribute the funds, you're doing so at your peril. And frankly, there's no obligation that I can see under the statute that these entities actually take the funds. I suppose if you were being prudent, you could keep it on the court's registry until after the conclusion of the direct appeal and distribute the funds then. The legislature's intent was never that the forfeiture, the funds or property received through forfeiture be a substitution for revenue. This is icing on the cake, as it were, for these entities. And so leaving the money on the court's registry strikes me as prudent if you think there's a good probability, or at least some probability, that the parallel criminal case might be reversed. The one thing I actually wanted to discuss briefly with your honors is this section 1.7c that Ms. Weiss referred to, and the fact that the prosecution in this case actually met these elements of proof. I would point out that under 303.5.2, these are required elements of proof in every forfeiture action. How I read this is what I think the legislature was doing was sort of establishing an escape hatch provision where, for instance, if the prosecuting authority makes a determination early on that, look, we're not going to be able to carry our burden of proof in a criminal case, we simply can't proceed against this individual. However, we do think that there's property that's connected to criminal activity here. This provision would allow the prosecution in those sorts of situations where they can't go forward with a criminal case in the first instance to nonetheless proceed against the property under civil forfeiture statute.
Didn't the people do both if they wanted to?
Well, they absolutely could. They absolutely could, but they didn't elect to do that in this case.
Mr. Walta, I'm having a problem with something that you said a while back where you said it wasn't their money to distribute. But there was a court order that said that they could distribute it and indicated, in fact, how it would be distributed. Does that affect your conclusion?
It doesn't affect my conclusion that the money was illegally seized. It's true that a court ratified the seizure, forfeiture, and distribution of this money. But I think Rule 60, along with 1613.307, certainly afforded Mr. Strand the right to go back in, vacate or set aside that forfeiture order, and seek the return of his property. Yes, I would agree with Your Honor that hindsight is 20/20 in this case, to be sure. But in my view, the notion that Mr. Strand is simply out of luck is troubling to me. That the notion that that there is no ability to go back and remedy the constitutional violation that pervaded both the criminal case and the forfeiture action. I don't think it's reasonable. Clearly, Judge Offler didn't think it was reasonable and made an equitable determination that the judgment should be set aside and that the money should be returned. And that's an equitable judgment that I think this court should accord deference to. Judge Offler sat on the forfeiture case, conducted the trial on the merits, and determined 4 years later that that order should be vacated and Mr. Strand should get his money back.
A brief request, interest, was that request made in the trial court?
It wasn't, Your Honor. It's and frankly, I looked at that, and given the complexities, as Judge Terry noted, the fact that you had at the time a valid court order in place awarding the prosecution that money, it struck me as there were some complexities there. And it's solely for purposes of the time spent on appeal. That's the limitation on our request. With that, I ask that the court affirm the order below. Unless there are any further questions, I do have 30 seconds.
Thank you, Mr. Walter.
Thank you.
Thank you again, Ms. Weiss. We appreciate both of your arguments this afternoon.